This edition of Meet the Writers was first broadcast on the 26th of December 2015 on Monocle 24. Welcome to Meet the Writers with me, Georgina Godwin. Erica Jong is probably best known for her book Fear of Flying, which has sold more than 27 million copies. It continues to fly off the shelves. It's been translated into 40 languages. In the 4 decades since that work, she's written over 21 books, including 9 works of fiction, as well as celebrated non-fiction volumes. Erica's one of the most evocative poets of her generation, with 7 published volumes. She's won a host of key poetry and literary prizes, and she taught us how to live. There is one essential rite of passage for teenage girls who came of age any time after the mid-70s, and it is to read Erica Jong. She's been with us through our first heartbreaks and sexual exploits, through our marriages and divorces. She's been there to pick us up over a solitary glass of Pinot Grigio and a boiled egg, and as an unseen member of our group of friends, contributing to the conversation. She has, of course, contributed to the wider conversation, and indeed the lexicon. Where would we be without the zipless fuck? Well, that wonderful phrase came from Fear of Flying, and it means so much more than just casual sex, doesn't it, Erica? How would you categorise the zipless fuck?
Well, it's the right of women to fantasize, which, honestly, they didn't think they had that right. And without fantasy, you can't have a satisfying sex life. That I'm sure of. And it also reflects the right of women to be self-affirming, to be who they are, to be who they want to be, and even to make mistakes. Because, you know, the zipless fuck, I notice we can say it on this radio program, can be very disappointing. Or you can fall in love for the rest of your life. It can be any number of things. And when I wrote about it, I was certainly not advocating a way of behavior. But if I was doing anything, it was saying we have a right to our imaginations. We have a right to experiment. We have a right to take risks. And it represents all those things metaphorically. A lot of people have no sense of humor, though, and they think that what I was advocating was women hopping from bed to bed to bed to bed. And in fact, when the book was published, I was very much attacked for that. And I'm not the sort of person who says, I'll tell you how to live your life. You know, I am not an agony aunt. Actually, I believe that the very essence of feminism is freedom.
You didn't prescribe how we must live our lives, but it was certainly a book that we all took to heart. And it was advice, I suppose, that book was about how to be young. And this, your new book, Fear of Dying, feels more like a manual for living now.
I hope it is, because, look, the poets know there are only 2 subjects for poetry, love and death. That's it. And yet, death is still a taboo. And we all will die. If we're lucky, our parents will die before us. That luck doesn't happen to everybody. And so we'll have to deal with the fact that as they get older and older, they become childlike to us, which is earth-shattering, you know? But it's also fortunate. Mm. My mother lived to 101. It's fortunate when your mother lives that long, but it's also an absolute cataclysm emotionally.
You tell the story through the eyes of Vanessa. She's an actress, and she's, I think, very wise. You yourself are known for your candour, and Vanessa, I think, speaks truth, and it is a book about truth. And in it, Vanessa says, women of my generation lie as easily as we kiss.
Do I say that? I can't remember. But anyway, I think, you know, she's an actress. She's 60 pretending to be 50. The reason she had to be an actress, which is quite different from being a writer, is that not only do actresses, are they judged on their looks, but they lose work when they reach a certain age. And that is really tragic. Mm. I have so many actor friends who have said to me, I just know my craft. I can do anything now. And that's the moment they can't get cast in anything. You know, I have one friend who's an award-winning actress who says, you know, I'm ready to play Lear. I actually use that in the book. And they want me to play grannies and great-grandmothers and trolls with green faces. What is this? So the fact that Vanessa Wunderman is an actress is very germane to the book.
Mm. She says at one point, plastic surgery is as mandatory as leg waxing. I mean, you haven't lost that humour. It still shines through, doesn't it, so much. You talk about being a mother, and you point out that one of the skills of motherhood is sometimes just not saying anything.
Well, that's the hardest thing about motherhood. And it's less true about grandmotherhood, because I have the kind of grandchildren who confide in me and who talk to me about all kinds of things. But I was very lucky with Molly, because Molly...
Who's your daughter?
Yeah, my daughter. I have a stepdaughter and a biological daughter, and Molly's my biological daughter. And my great luck with Molly was she always told me what was bothering her. And I think it saved her life, really. Hmm. When she was going through all that adolescent stuff, including experimenting with mind-altering substances, she told me. And in being able to tell me, she could tell herself.
You say that aging is not just about flesh. It's about our great expectations when we're young. And I think that plays into what you're saying about your daughter. And also Vanessa, the character, is writing a play, and she talks about what is magic, but the deep intent to change.
I think that's true, actually, because in an earlier draft of this book, I had Vanessa meeting with witches who took her back to looking 30. And she becomes young again, knowing what she knows, you know, what she knows now, which is a perpetual fantasy. Oh, if only I were 30 and I knew everything that I know now. Well, that draft of the book did not work. Mm-hmm. And didn't work because the fulfillment of that magical fantasy, you know, it's an old plot. It's Plotto 163 or something. But it's an old plot. But for me, that draft didn't work at all.
Yeah. I mean, as you say, immortality without youth is to be feared.
Yeah, right.
Isn't it?
You
yeah.
don't.
Yeah. In this book, Isadora, who is the lead character in Fear of Flying, she appears again in this book, but she's a friend. So are you less Isadora than you were, or were you never Isadora?
Oh, I really don't even know the answer to that, really. I can say that I look at the different female characters I've created, and they've all been really instrumental in my understanding myself. But the choices I made at different times in my life, I'm not even sure I understand those choices. I mean, Isadora in Fear of Flying is 29 going on 30. So that's a passage in a woman's life. I've never been this old before sort of passage. And we think 29 going on 30, we worry about our 30th birthday, which now I find laughable, okay? But Vanessa is 60, and her daughter's having a baby, her first baby. Her dog is dying, Belinda Barkowitz, the big old poodle.
And you point out that we measure our lives, dogs are passages in our lives.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, because they don't live as long as we do. And so it's heartbreaking when they get old and they begin to fail. Heartbreaking. And then you have these long conversations with the veterinarian. When will it be time? And the veterinarian almost becomes a shrink. You know, is it kinder to let her go or kinder to try to heal her? You know, so many conversations like that in my life over dogs I've loved. And at least we can let them go, which in many states in America, you can't do with your parents.
Well, and that's the thing. And this book is a lot about that. It's about how hard it is to let your parents grow. And you tell this wonderful story about the baby eaglets.
My mother used to tell that story.
Will you share it with us?
Yes, I will. My mother always used to say, and it was a clear message to us, her daughters, there's a mother eagle sitting on a nest and she hatches three baby eaglets. And she's trying to teach them about life. And so she says to the babies, when I am old and I need care, what will you do? And the first one, this is very Lyrian in a way. I mean, King Lyrian. The first one says, oh, mother, I will sacrifice everything to take care of you. And the second one says, oh, mother, you are my beloved. I will never leave you. I will bring you food and blah, blah, blah. And the third one says, mother, when you are old, I will have baby eaglets of my own, and they will be my priority. And the mother knows that that is the baby she will save if it ever comes to that, because life has to go on. And why did my mother tell us this? Because I think that was her deep belief in life goes on. You do not. I mean, she was giving us a message, really. You do not sacrifice your life for your parents. Your parents raised you. Your parents tried to educate you. But life goes on is the most important lesson. And sometimes my mother would say, and I've stolen this for Vanessa's mother, never forget that life is a comedy. You know, sometimes life feels like an unbearable tragedy. But, and for so many people it is, you look at the world and you look at women being shot in the head for advocating education for women, little Syrian boys turning up dead on the beaches of Sappho's Island. And I've been writing quite a lot of poetry about those events. But life can be a tragedy, but we are so lucky in living where we live and having the opportunities that we have, which most of the world does not have.
As you point out, lingering, of course, may be worse than death.
Yeah, well, you know that famous Tennyson poem about Tithonus, the woods decay and die. And it's a story, a nymph falls madly in love with Tithonus and begs the gods for immortality, but she forgets to beg the gods for eternal youth. And he wanders through the woods, Tithonus, unable to die, and with flesh falling off the bone. And I think Tennyson wrote one of his greatest poems about that, and it's a beautiful poem.
Your letter, the letter to your mother in the book about her loss of speech, absolutely reduced me to tears. I mean, this is a deeply affecting work.
Is it the one where I say, dear mother, please never die? Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, when your parents get old, you go back and forth between being afraid they'll die and wishing to let them have some peace. And it becomes this terrible ambivalent dance. And my mother had a very good death. She came to a point where she was really ready. And she passed from breath to no breath. And I and my younger sister arrived right after. Her caregiver called us, and when we came over, she was warm. And I kept kissing her on the cheek. She had just gone. I mean, really. And the night before, I had seen her, and she was breathing. She had an oxygen tube in her nose. And she was excited because I was wearing a purple and red blouse. And she was a painter, and she loved color. And she tried to get up and touch my blouse. And I knew what she was saying, which was, the purple and the red, I love it. I knew that. But I don't think we understand the old. And I think we should learn.
You talk about the idea of your life projected against the curve of time. I thought that was a wonderful way to look at a human lifespan.
Yeah, I think it's important. You know, we go through certain things because of the ages in which we live. You know, the Chinese proverb, may you live in interesting times, which is a curse, of course. But it is interesting to understand history and where you fit in it. I've met so many Chinese people who grew up under Mao and whose lives were so marked by that historical moment. I mean, the doctor who's my acupuncturist in Connecticut, B. became a Chinese doctor because his mother dumped him in her brother's office in Beijing while she worked in a factory in the Mao period. His father disappeared, probably for political reasons, we don't know. And so he was left with his mother's brother as babysitter, and he sat in that office learning about herbs, acupuncture, Chinese medicine. So we have to always realize that our lives are kind of the intersection of history and individuality. But history really matters. And I think everybody should study ancient history and modern history, because that's the only way you come to know the world, I think.
You write about the more club and how that's a kind of curse, really. We all just want more all the time. When will it be enough?
It's never enough. As long as you are spending your time acquiring, it's never enough. I mean, look at these oligarchs who are buying flats in New York. I mean, I look out the window. I'm on the 27th floor of a really tall apartment building. And I look out, and they're building 100-story buildings that are completely empty, except for the oligarchs who come there 2 weeks a year, perhaps at Christmas time or Easter time or whatever. And the same thing is happening in London. These buildings are mostly unoccupied. And the apartments are being bought by people who want to plant their money in some place they feel is secure.
I want to go back, if I may, just to, well, it's to this book, it's to Fear of Dying, but the book itself, I think, references your own life and your previous work, in that you say that you're sick to death of writing honestly about women and sex, and that if you're trying to save the female sex to receive gratitude, forget it, that isn't going to happen. And that seemed to me that that was really you talking about yourself.
Well, you know, most feminists misunderstand feminism, in my opinion. Feminism is free speech. Feminism is allowing women to make their own choices. The last thing we need are these La Leche people saying, if you don't breastfeed your baby, you're a bad feminist. And if you don't do this, you're a bad feminist. Mm. I mean, look, feminism begins in our culture with Mary Wollstonecraft, who was a member of the Enlightenment. She went to dinner with Thomas Paine, not romantically, but I'm sure they discussed ideas. We are on a continuum that starts in the Enlightenment. It is about human rights. It is about the rights of women, the rights of men, the rights of children, the rights of people of color, and the rights of the disabled. You could add all these things. But what we are trying to do is to liberate, not proscribe. Mm. And when women tell me that I'm a bad feminist because I don't believe in XYZ, I think they don't understand our movement. This is not a movement of trying to shame each other. I don't get that, really. You know, I arrive in London and there are people saying that they're trying to deplatform Germaine Greer, who has written some wonderful books. And, okay, they don't think that she agrees with them about something. Who cares what, you know? But why not honor that person and say she's written wonderful books? So maybe she tweeted something that was taken out of context. I don't even really know what happened. But this desire to judge all the time, it's the antithesis, I think, of what we wanted.
You say the word can't save the world.
Well, all my life I believed that the word could save the world. And I do still believe that, because I am aware that every important movement for liberation, and I'm talking about the 18th century, which was my period in graduate school and which I love, it's the period in which it's the age of revolution. It's the age when the French, you know, killed each other because they disagreed about this and that. French Revolution went on for about a decade, right? And they all killed each other, guillotined each other. But it was the beginning of the struggle for human rights. And it started with books. So I don't completely believe that. I think Vanessa is more cynical than I am.
The book, the latest book, is about death, as we've said, but it's also about new life. Vanessa's daughter, Glinda, has a baby. And you talk about childbirth and the heroism of mothers, which absolutely makes the world go round, and how really only, and now I suppose you're a grandmother, so you speak from experience, but how grandmothers may be the only women in the world to understand the proper place of men.
Do I really say that? Okay. But, you know, it's interesting. I think we need men to be our allies. We're not going to make a revolution in human rights alone. We also need children. We need to understand that feminism is mentoring, not judging. Mm. We need, you know, every year my daughter and I make a big party for women writers in New York. The ones who are her age, she's 37, and the ones who are my age. And we try to bring them all together and set up a situation where they can mentor each other and help each other. A lot of these women are journalists. Many of them write blogs or have published one novel or one book of poems. Many of my friends have been publishing for 40 years, and they meet each other and they talk. And I think that's what feminism is.
It's an extraordinary book in that it makes sense of so many of the ideas that we first came across in Fear of Flying. And one of the ideas that I love was about immortality. Now, Vanessa, as we said, is an actress, and she thinks that perhaps immortality is her soap operas streaming into space forever. But it does give rise to questions of archive, because particularly when she's packing up her mother's house and trying to find homes for photographs and wanting a museum or something.
Right.
Maybe we can all live on digitally. It doesn't even have to be a soap opera.
Well, we'll see. I mean, I don't know. I think the digital world has been oversold. I shudder when I hear about the cloud. Of course, I use the cloud. We all do. But just at the moment when you need your telephone most, you can't get Wi-Fi. Mm. I shudder to think of our dependence on this technology because, first of all, it's so eminently hackable, number one. You know, my husband now goes around with a little device that changes the code on our bank accounts minute by minute. So we're not doing so well with the digital world. Mm. And there are plenty of young people out there all over the world who know how to hack these things. One of the reasons I think people loved Stieg Larsson was because his heroine could hack into other people's. It was the first time you had a female hacker getting rich off men because she could hack into their bank account. That was a stroke of brilliance on his part.
The book ends in India, where we see the past of the human race.
Yes.
You talk about immortality versus extinction and the Indian ideal and religion, really. And I wonder if this faith that comes through at the end of the book, and you don't specify what faith, it's just kind of faith in love and life, if that reflects your own existence.
Well, I do believe that there's a creative spirit in the universe and that it is embodied in what Dylan Thomas called the force that through the green fuse feeds the flower. And, you know, I was born Jewish but not observant. I came from a family of intellectuals who were not observant. Although we have a lot of pride in our tribe, which is a reading, writing tribe, you know, who have produced many works of literature and science. However, I do think there's a creative force in the universe and a profoundly destructive one. And the destructive one at this moment is winning. And I worry tremendously, as Einstein did, about our ability to exterminate the human race. Not just with atom bombs, but with chemicals. One of those idiotic Republican candidates tweeted, "Environmentalism is not a science, it's a religion." I can't remember which one of the clowns tweeted that. It could have been any of them, because they're all idiots, I mean, and dangerous guys. I mean, they're all dangerous. Donald Trump is dangerous because he's so ignorant. He doesn't know there hasn't been a Mexican-American immigration in 20 years, number one. Also, Ben Carson says, well, I have no experience in government, but God opened a door. My husband sits at the TV set and says, and what about the window God opened? You know, so, I mean, we have these dangerous people running for president.
Are you a Hillary supporter?
Of course. She's the only one who has experience, smarts, understanding of foreign affairs. There's no contest here. It's so ridiculous. I mean, look at the people running on the Republican side.
You know,
Carly Fiorina, who was fired as a CEO because she lost so much money for her company, and who lies, who goes up on the stand and says Planned Parenthood was dissecting babies, and which has been completely repudiated. You know, they were not. They were not selling dead babies. This, but you know, the press in America and to some extent in the UK is not fact-checking anymore. Why are they not fact-checking? People say these outrageous things. And where is the press, you know, correcting these lies?
You talk about the creative force. And to end, I just wondered if you could tell me where your creative force is leading you next.
I've started a new novel, which is set during the French Revolution and is a fictionalized story of the woman who was court painter to Marie Antoinette, Elizabeth Louise Vigée Le Brun, who nobody knows about because she was a woman, and who painted thousands of portraits of all the crowned heads of Europe because 2 weeks after the Bastille fell, she left Paris. She would have been murdered, as Marie Antoinette was, and her husband, and her children. One of those children survived, Maria Therese, who was named after Antoinette's or Antoine's mother, Maria Theresa. But she never had children. But the cruelty of that revolution. But anyway, what is very interesting to me, here was this female painter who was good friends with Marie Antoinette, and I wanted to see the world through her eyes.
And your poems continue?
Yeah, I've finished a new book of poems, which is called The World Began with Yes, which is a line from Clarice Lispector, who's a Portuguese writer, Brazilian, but originally Jewish from Russia as a baby. But she's a fabulous writer and a wonderful philosopher. And people in Brazil call her better than Kafka. And she has a kind of Kafkaesque feeling. I don't know if she's known here, but there are new translations of her books in America. She wrote in Portuguese.
And of course, Fear of Dying is out now. Erica Jong, thank you so much for coming on to speak to me. And that, I'm afraid, brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Meet the Writers with me, Georgina Godwin. My guest today was Erica Jong. My producer was Claire Urban, and you can join us again at the same time next week when I'll be talking to award-winning Nigerian poet and novelist Ben Okri. But for now, thanks very much for listening, and goodbye.